Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Tom Hayden, former California state senator and veteran peace and civil rights organizer, who discusses the danger of a new Cold War with Russia and policy options to end the bloody conflict in eastern Ukraine. Four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who observes that the ongoing Gaza conflict is an inevitable result of Israel's suffocating economic blockade and more than 45 years of illegal occupation. And Dylan Voorhees of the Natural Resources Council of Maine, who discusses the national significance of a Maine city ordinance that blocks the loading of tar sands onto tankers for export around the world. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A punishing drought has gripped the Middle East, exacerbating conflict in Syria and Iraq. In eastern Turkey, the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers have fallen to half their normal levels. According to Mother Jones magazine, Iraq set a high temperature record from March to May. At the same time, fighters from the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, mounted an offensive in Iraq, often using the control of water resources as a weapon of war. Throughout the Middle East, severe drought, largely driven by climate change, has led to instability and food shortages. The United Nations ranks Iraq as one of the Arab nations most vulnerable to climate change. Back in 2004, the U.S. Congressional Research Service concluded Iraq has grown dependent on food imports because of rapid population growth and a stagnant agricultural sector. This winter, Iraq's wheat harvest was 45% below normal, causing many farmers to abandon their fields and flee to overcrowded cities. Colombian labor leader Cesar Flores was afraid to pick up his phone after receiving repeated death threats. In April, a poster appeared in his workplace declaring Flores and other union leaders permanent military targets. In June, Flores resigned from the union local that represents Colombian workers at the U.S.-owned Drummond Company, which has a long history of violent attacks against unions. A year ago, the union went on strike against the Alabama-based coal giant, demanding a pay increase and a salary system for workers replacing hourly wages. The strike lasted for 53 days, and the threats against Flores increased, mostly from a local paramilitary group with ties to drug traffickers. In a series of lawsuits, Drummond was linked to right-wing paramilitary groups, including the now-disbanded AUC, Autodefensas Unidas de Colombia. According to the Center for Public Integrity, the suits were filed by Terry Collingsworth, who has sued Dole Foods and Chiquita Brands over human rights abuses. One of the lawsuits charged Drummond with responsibility for the murder of three union leaders. The suit, brought in U.S. courts, was initially dismissed but is now on appeal. 20-year-old Minnesotan Cliff Morton works three low-paid jobs, but he still can't make it without assistance from the Medicaid healthcare program, and he lives with his father to save money. Progressive groups assert that Morton's employers should have to pay a penalty for refusing to provide a living wage and forcing their workers to enroll in public assistance programs. Take Action Minnesota, an affiliate of National People's Action, is now proposing legislation for 2015 that would establish a bad business fee, forcing employers to disclose how many workers are on public assistance like food stamps or Medicaid. Then each company would pay a fee based on the public subsidies paid to the employer's low-income workforce. According to the news magazine In These Times, the bad business fee endorsed by National People's Action and Jobs with Justice will help create a new narrative around the issues of economic inequality and corporate welfare, especially among big retailers like Target, Walmart, and fast food outlets like McDonald's. Advocates hope to appeal to red state communities tired of giving hidden taxpayer-funded subsidies to giant profitable corporations. In a recent study, Americans for Tax Fairness estimated that Walmart costs taxpayers $6.2 billion annually in public assistance to support the company's underpaid workers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill. We'll be right back.
In the aftermath of the shooting down of a Malaysian civilian airliner over the war zone in eastern Ukraine that killed all 298 aboard, the U.S. and Europe announced aggressive new economic sanctions against Russia. President Obama and the European Union unveiled new punitive measures on July 29th, targeting Moscow for what Washington and Brussels assert is Russian President Vladimir Putin's aggressive military support for pro-Russian separatists fighting for autonomy in eastern Ukraine. President Obama accused Russia of firing artillery across its border, providing the rebels heavy military equipment, and massing troops along the Ukrainian frontier. The new measures include sanctions aimed at Russian banks, the nation's defense firms, and blocking technology sales to Russia's oil industry. When asked by reporters, President Obama denied that Washington and Europe's actions to isolate Russia constituted the launch of a new Cold War, and stated that he is not planning to transfer U.S. military equipment to Ukraine's government, as many Republican politicians have recently advocated. But in an apparent escalation of the combat in eastern Ukraine, three U.S. government officials reported that the Ukrainian army had fired short-range ballistic missiles aimed at territory controlled by pro-Russian separatists. Earlier, Washington had accused Russia of violating the Intermediate-Range Nuclear Force Treaty by testing ground-launched cruise missiles. Your reporter spoke with Tom Hayden, former California state senator, veteran peace and civil rights organizer, widely known as a founding member of Students for a Democratic Society, and primary author of the Port Huron Statement. Here, Hayden discusses the danger of a new Cold War and the policy options to reduce tensions and end the bloody conflict in eastern Ukraine that thus far has claimed over 1,100 lives.
My sense is that the American fatigue with going to war is juxtaposed with the American suspicion or hostility to all things Russian. So that's a Cold War hangover. The period of coexistence and handshakes and so forth between the United States and Russia is ended. And so there's a Cold War mood in the air. But I think at the end of the day, the United States will be, the hawks in our country will be restrained by the problems of success and cost, affordability. So that's where we are, and I'm glad that there's an opportunity for some public discussion about it. But the last thing we need, in my opinion, is a second version of the Cold War.
The shooting down of the Malaysian civilian airliner over eastern Ukraine really has focused world attention on the crisis in Ukraine and the danger of escalation. And as public officials look to cast blame on the eastern Ukraine separatists or Vladimir Putin, it was kind of jarring to hear the chairman of the Pentagon's Joint Chief of Staff, Martin Dempsey, recently compare Russian President Vladimir Putin's action in Ukraine to Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin's 1939 invasion of Poland. Seems to me that's pretty dangerous and reckless rhetoric coming from the top guy at the Pentagon.
Yeah, and you know, he may believe it, and he said similar things in the past few days. And, you know, there is this anticipation that there might have to be a war. So let's sort this out. The Cold War is over, and the right wing thinks that they won. So they're very confused about this set of events in the Ukraine, which makes it appear that Russia's back. And the reality is that anybody who looks at a map is Ukraine is on Russia's border, and the eastern Ukraine is Russian, Russian-speaking. And the U.S. has been trying to support in Kiev and western Ukraine a market system economically, and has pushed for military alliances, you know, all around the border, most notably in Georgia. And whenever they get near the border, they get pushed back, which would happen between Russia and Georgia just 4 years ago. And so I was talking to some supporters and congressional staff and a senator a few weeks ago and asked, you know, what do you expect if you push a paranoid Russian bear in his cave to be the reaction? And what exactly are you planning to do about the reaction? Because I thought it would be a military reaction eventually, and I still think it will be. So they really can't afford a military conflict, and I would hope that Obama is trying to navigate his way out of it. Whoever shot down the plane, and I'm certainly prepared to believe that it was insane or renegade pro-Russian separatists with equipment supplied by the Russians, but not something that the Russians would think was a useful idea. I mean, it just was a disaster from every point of view, moral, diplomatic. It encouraged, an increased escalation. So that will be the pretext for further escalation. But I'm still hopeful that it won't happen because it can't. We can't afford it. We can't do it.
Tom, I would ask you this. If a new Cold War is brewing with Russia, who profits? It seems that some of the big armaments and aerospace companies are the big profiteers here if we get into a new arms race with Russia.
It might be about arms profiteers, no question about that. They're not excited about peace. But I think it benefits Republicans. I think it's an easy, cheap attack on Obama and the Democrats because they misled us about Russia. Now they've been proven wrong. And the implicit Republican message is they're not men enough to stand up to those Russians. This never would have happened if we had real men in the White House. So elect us. And as usual, they're not obligated to explain what exactly they would do. If they said, well, we should go to war with Russia, then public opinion would run away from them. But that question isn't asked. And I hope that the microphones are pointed at Republicans.
That was Tom Hayden, former California state senator, veteran peace and civil rights organizer, and a founding member of Students for a Democratic Society. Find links to Hayden's recent commentary on Ukraine and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the bloodshed in the ongoing Battle of Gaza entered its fourth week, more than 1,060 Palestinians in Gaza, more than 70% of them civilians, have been killed, with more than 6,200 wounded, according to the United Nations. Israel has lost 53 soldiers, the largest toll since its 2006 war with Lebanon. Hamas mortar and rocket attacks from Gaza have killed two Israeli civilians and one Thai worker in Israel. After Israel rejected a ceasefire draft proposed by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, the UN Security Council called on July 28th for an immediate and unconditional humanitarian ceasefire in the Gaza war, joining a similar call by President Barack Obama a day earlier. In rebuffing international demands for an end to his nation's military assault on Gaza, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in a televised address, quote, "We will not finish the mission, we will not finish the operation, without neutralizing the tunnels through which Hamas fighters have sought to infiltrate Israel." For its part, Gaza's Hamas government is demanding that any ceasefire include an end to the economic blockade, the easing of travel restrictions, and the release of Hamas members who were jailed after the killing of three Jewish teenagers in the West Bank last month. The Israeli military operation, known as Protective Edge, continued the destruction of targets in Gaza that included underground tunnels, suspected sites of rocket launchers and arms caches, and the homes of Hamas leaders. Several Gaza hospitals and UN-operated schools used as shelters have also been attacked. In addition, Gaza's only power plant was shelled, cutting off electric power for vital services, including water and sanitation. Your reporter spoke with citizen activist, author, and four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who observes that the ongoing Gaza conflict is an inevitable result of Israel's suffocating economic blockade and more than 45 years of illegal occupation.
Well, as the Israeli peace movement and the Israeli soldiers who are now called refuseniks, they basically say If you end the occupation, end the siege, the blockade, the restrictions on food, medicine, electricity, water, construction materials, and let the economy develop a little bit in Gaza, that you won't have this frustration that builds up. And, of course, the Gazans get the attention when they send the rockets. They've sent over 2,000 rockets, and they haven't killed one person in Israel. Two have died in Israel, one from a heart attack and one from a mortar near a tank. So luckily for the Israelis, these are the most inaccurate dud-type rockets imaginable. But they're the ones that give the excuse for the Israelis to pound with precision artillery and missiles the Gazan people. And it's just a small area, twice the size of the District of Columbia, has 1.8 million people there. And it's been called by friend and foe alike the world's largest open prison. And so day after day, you have children severely ill because of anemia, because of malnutrition. That doesn't make news. Day after day, you have seizure of Gazans who are put in jail without charges. That doesn't make news. Day after day, you have people in the military in Israel taking the lives of Gazans, like they'll kill a farmer tilling a little piece of land. Oh, gee, the farmer was menacing. And that doesn't get any news. So after a while, the Gazans feel like they're suffocating, and they have some sort of pride that they have to resist this kind of domination. I mean, what would we do if a giant power dominated us like that, carved up our land, besieged us, kept the necessity of life away? So the American people are not getting that kind of story. And they're getting stories like all the Hamas are nothing and Gazans are terrorists. The Israelis are people who are defending themselves. Well, you know, when you have a giant power, the fourth most powerful army in the world, right on top, stomping on what a Israeli newspaper columnist in Haaretz called a completely defenseless people. I mean, who's got the responsibility to stop the fighting? Who's got the responsibility to stop the illegal siege, the blockade, the restrictions on water and electricity and medicine? People in Gaza have cancer. They can't get the medicine. People want to feed their families. They can't feed their families. So we need the USA to step up. President Obama mouths the AIPAC oath every time something like this happens over there. Well, Israel has a right to defend itself. Well, do the Gazans have a right to be liberated from an illegal military occupation, violating UN charter resolutions, violating international law, Geneva Conventions? Of course. But it's never posed that way. Now, since the American taxpayer is funding Israel to at least $3.1 billion a year and a lot of other assistance by loans that are often forgiven, and since the U.S. blocks any attempt in the U.N., which created Israel in 1947-48, from even denouncing the massive loss of civilian life and children and women, and the attack by Israeli military of schools and hospitals and homes and public buildings. And nothing is off limits, even the UN compounds. Nothing is off limits. And the U.S. vetoes, threatens a veto in the Security Council. So President Obama, the least he should do, as I said in a letter to him the other day, is to launch a major humanitarian effort, because it's a major humanitarian crisis, to get water and medicine and food and shelter to these people.
That was citizen activist, author, and four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader. His newest book is titled Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. Find a link to Ralph Nader's recent commentary on the Gaza War and related news articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On July 21st, South Portland, Maine City Council, with a population of 25,000, voted 6-1 to approve what's known as the Clear Skies Ordinance, a regulation that blocks the loading of tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, onto tankers at the city's harbor for export around the world. A proposal initiated by ExxonMobil's subsidiary, the Portland Pipeline Corporation, would reverse the flow of conventional oil that currently moves west through a pipeline from the city to Canada, to a new eastbound flow carrying Alberta tar sands through an aging pipeline to Portland's waterfront. Similar to the dirty process of extracting tar sands oil, transporting it exacts an environmental cost. The heavy, almost solid bitumen can only be moved through pipelines after it's thinned out with a mixture of liquid natural gas and other petroleum products to something called diluted bitumen, or dilbit. And then it can only be loaded onto tankers after the added ingredients are burned off. ExxonMobil has secured permits to build two facilities on South Portland's harbor to do the burning. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus covered the start of the campaign opposing the flow of tar sands into Maine at a rally in January 2013. After South Portland's recent city council vote, she spoke with Dylan Voorhees, clean energy director with the Natural Resources Council of Maine, which was one of the groups supporting the Clear Skies Ordinance. Here he explains how the vote succeeded, why it's considered of national importance in the fight to stop tar sands extraction and export, and what the city can expect from big oil companies who want to overturn the ordinance and see the pipeline project proceed.
To load crude oil, including tar sands, onto tankers requires the construction of a variety of polluting infrastructure that doesn't exist there today, that doesn't exist when you take crude oil off of tankers. And this includes loading facilities that have quite a lot of pollution from burning off the chemicals from the operation of loading tar sands and crude oil onto tankers. And at the end of the day, that was the concern that really drove multiple proposals to protect the city from a tar sands loading facility and the smokestacks and construction of a terminal to do that.
I'm sure there were a lot of pressures and different points of view for the city councilors to consider. How was the organizing done to get 6 out of the 7 of them to vote in favor of this ordinance?
Well, there really has been a long effort, and it's been led by a large group of really committed citizens and residents of South Portland. Last year, residents in South Portland came together. They formed a group called Protect South Portland, a citizen-led organization. They actually brought an ordinance to the ballot last fall, and so there was an enormous amount of community education and organizing around that. And it was very, very narrowly defeated because the oil industry had really attacked it very, I think, dishonestly, and it was defeated by a very small number of votes. But the city council was persuaded by the concerns of citizens to try again, and they set up a committee to develop another ordinance that would protect the city from this kind of tar sands facility and the air pollution associated with it. And I think the mood in the community is really fairly clear. They don't really want this. Their air quality is already an issue. There's a lot of schools that are exposed to chemicals and fumes in problematic ways already. The counter has really been the American Petroleum Institute and oil interests that really are disconnected in a real way from South Portland. There's no benefit from South Portland from having smokestacks and a terminal to load tar sands onto tankers. That's not a local benefit. It's an oil industry benefit. So the American Petroleum Institute, the national lobbying arm for, you know, that's big oil, if there ever was big oil, spent about $700,000 in this very small city to defeat and attack this referendum last year, and they tried hard to attack the ordinance that the city council supported. But they really just weren't successful because ultimately it's not a contest when you have the interests of sort of out of state, far away tar sands profits compared to the health of the air that residents and kids and the elderly all breathe. So when it comes down to that contest, really, it's nice to see local elected officials responding and they certainly responded very clearly and positively to this ordinance in South Portland.
Dylan Voorhees, there are a lot of proposed pipelines in the U.S. and across Canada. The articles I've read indicate that this vote in South Portland is considered of national significance. Do you agree with that? And if so, why?
I do. And I think that it is important when you see the full pattern of communities resisting tar sands and trying to face down a variety of those threats. And lots of communities have faced threats from tar sands in lots of different ways. From up in Alberta, where clearly communities are being horrifically impacted by the extraction and mining operations, to communities where there are pipelines and pipeline spills have impacted or threatened communities, to a city like South Portland, where you have a potential loading operation that would put air pollution into their communities by their schools. So I think that it's significant because the pattern that is emerging is communities saying no to these variety of threats of tar sands. And I think the oil industry and the tar sands industry is just has to reckon with them.
So what's the next step? I read that lawsuits are very likely by Portland Pipeline Corporation or possibly even the government of Canada. What can you tell us about that?
Those deep-pocketed oil resources certainly have suggested that they are considering legal action, and that could happen in federal court, could be a number of parties. The city stands, I think, confidently to defend the ordinance. There was a really great, transparent, deliberative process that put the ordinance together. A number of organizations, such as the Conservation Law Foundation, have stepped up very articulately to describe why the ordinance will withstand a legal challenge and that they will participate, as will Natural Resources Council of Maine, in making sure that the ordinance is well defended in court. So that's the decision of the oil industry, whether they want to put the community through that costly legal challenge. If they do, we're confident that they'll ultimately lose.
That was Dylan Voorhees, Clean Energy Director with the Natural Resources Council of Maine. For more news and analysis on environmental and climate change groups' opposition to tar sands pipelines, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.